Welcome to the Anthro to UX podcast, where you will learn how to break into UX with an anthropology degree. Through conversations with leading anthropologists working in user experience, you will learn firsthand how others made the transition, what they learned along the way, and what they would do differently. We will be discussing what it means to do UX research from a practical perspective and what you need to do to prepare a resume and portfolio. I'm your host, Matt Arts, a business anthropologist specializing in design anthropology and working at the intersection of product management, user experience, and business strategy. Let's get started. All right. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Anthro to UX podcast. I'm Matt Arts. I'm here today with Fatima Richmond, who recently moved to the Google DeepMind team, previously UX manager for the health team at Google, and some great experience before that at both Google and LinkedIn and other roles. So Fatima, thanks for joining me today. Would you start by telling everybody how you got interested in anthropology?
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me. So I started, down this journey of anthropology through computer science. I knew very early on that I didn't want to necessarily talk to computers my entire life. I love humans. I love understanding stories and telling stories. So a good friend of mine in the design department said, "Hey, have you heard of human-computer interaction?" And I was like, "Yeah, that sounds like really cool. It's a kind of a combination of a lot of different aspects of who I am and what I believe in when it came to technology." I felt really constrained just like following instructions for a computer. I just felt like, where's the human in this process? And this is 20 plus years ago. So in college, most of my computer science teacher was like, "Yeah, there's a little bit of usability, that's it." And I'm like, no, the big pictures, the societal issues with technology, the psychology of technology use. And so I went down this journey to really reflect on my abilities and what I wanted to complement my computer science degree with. And so back then, there weren't a lot of HCI programs, human-computer interaction programs. So you kind of had to mix and match a lot of different things based on your abilities and your gap in your abilities. And so for me, coming from a very technical background, I really wanted to immerse and challenge myself into what it meant to analyze humans in an ethical way, which I don't think my brain had really gotten challenged on. So I enrolled in applied anthropology at San Jose State University. I also took programs at UC Berkeley in ethnographic research in the Department of Sociology. So back then it was called the Center of Urban Ethnography, where they taught you about qualitative analysis, how to form just a research or social inquiry plan, and just really challenged me on the idea of how you hypothesize about humans, how you study them, and how you keep this kind of humanistic perspective in human-computer interaction. I think San Jose State helped me with understanding more of the critical theory and critical thought and the history of critical thought around anthropology and how you apply it to business cases. So in that process of design classes, human factors, applied anthropology, ethnography at Berkeley, it was a lot of traveling around the Bay Area. It was really helpful, though, because it really expanded my perspective of humans in technology development. And I just fell in love. And I've just had an amazing opportunity to apply that to primarily enterprise user research, so studying B2B solutions at SAP, Kyocera, Microsoft, and now Google. And the last few years, I've been interested in how do I apply all of that knowledge to research operations and programs.
So you joined this applied anthropology program. What did you actually focus on in that program?
Oh, my interests were focused on the anthropology of work. So I got really interested in the digital divide. At the time, the digital divide was a huge topic, the same way product inclusion is now. I would say it's maybe an evolution of the digital divide discussions. At the time, 20 years ago, the digital divide was all about access to technology. Like, oh, these certain communities and certain groups have all like this access to technology and others don't. And one particular place that a lot of Berkeley and sociology researchers focused on was right here in the Bay Area, that kind of divide between Stanford, Palo Alto, and you go across 101 to East Palo Alto. 20 years ago, you could see that access issue pretty clearly there, right here in the Bay Area. And a lot of my professors, Chuck Dora, Jan Lewis, Luik, they all focused on kind of the shadows of Silicon Valley. So while we talk a lot about technology, there are individuals that live in this area that ironically don't have any access to technology. And a lot of people couldn't understand why. How is that possible? Silicon Valley is known for being the heart of it. Well, it's because there's a lot of nuance there. And so I just started getting really interested in critically reflecting on how the digital divide can happen. What mechanisms and processes influence the digital divide? And so that's when I started getting into, okay, how do engineers work who develop the technology? How do they work with designers who design the technology? And then how do they work with researchers who study the technology? So it's almost like this meta view of human-computer interaction, not just how it applies to product, but how do we even organize structures in the workplace, especially structures that may have different culture and norms? How do we structure them to create this technology and close the digital divide? Or are there barriers to that or power dynamics that prevent that? Those were kind of my questions that led into the specialty of anthropology of work. And so I knew a lot about, you know, Bruno Latour and his work of engineer culture. And I knew a lot about Laura Nader and her ability to study up and her encouraging folks to study, researchers to study up. And I felt like that needed to be kind of applied to this very practical digital divide discussion, but from within an organization. So anthropology of work became my special sauce and something I really got passionate about. And I was able to apply it in a very practical way because I was during the day doing enterprise user research. So it was an interesting kind of applied and critical theoretical perspective of human computer interaction. So it's very meta, if that makes any sense, you know, applying it, but then also observing how we work together to create the technology.
And so you just said that you were during the day you were doing enterprise research. So at what point during those studies or even prior to that did you move into that work?
So again, back in the day, it wasn't really formalized as UX. I know it's hard for us to remember a time where we weren't called UX, but at the time, in 2005, it was like usability engineering, or you would have scientists like cognitive psychologists or social scientists working in the lab, in a dark lab somewhere. And so I found a role in usability engineering, which was very much evaluative UX. And that's when I started to learn about the different types and different flavors of UX, the different methods. And so I think usability engineering is a really great, or usability analysts, or I think those are really good opportunities to really hone in on the craft, the basics of being a user researcher. So like interviewing and how you have to adapt your interview style for different conversations, how you have to work with stakeholders to analyze that data and analyze it in an ethical way. You have to repeat that quite a bit in a usability type of role. So my first role was usability evaluations of printer interfaces for B2B businesses. These aren't the regular printers at home where you're clicking flyers. These are business printers that are upward of 10,000 or so, maybe even more, for companies who have large volumes of printing. So things like eco-friendly and the experience when you go from your desk and you walk over to the printer room and print, like that's an actual experience for B2B companies. And so I worked on that, and that was really exciting. Just learned the basics of just doing over and over and over again the fundamental methods of user research, like interviewing, like surveying, working with the team, working with dynamics within a team. And then from there, I went into other flavors of UX. So that was usability. But then in SAP, I always say that was a very formidable role because we went from, you know, user-centered process in the centralized team to expanding to a decentralized team to a design thinking team. And so I got to see all three of those different processes across a company, like how they position the design thinking team to be effective, which is in the office of the CEO or innovation, co-innovation center, versus how they position more of a UCD team that has to change every 6 months and learn a new product or tool and run those studies effectively. And then how do you keep that rigor up when you're working between two organizations and two different countries? SAP is headquartered in Europe, and you know, we were part of the Palo Alto division. And so there's a difference in culture and how you even implement those different studies. And so we had to go through quite a bit of training, you know, even if you were experienced, you were either leading the training or adapting the training or part of the training, and even non-researchers were a part of it. So I just learned a lot about how you keep that rigor up and keep that quality up, but also how you move really quickly at different phases of the product, depending on what your company wants to deliver. If they want to deliver innovation, it was more upfront. If they wanted to, you know, refine existing products and benchmark them, it was more at the end. And so just having that flexibility during SAP, which is only 3.5, 4 years, but it was a lot to, you know, understand the dynamics of how the organizational environment, the position of your user research team can have a different impact and outcome across the board. So it was a very formidable time. And then after that, it was just different leadership roles. And then now exploring more of the research programs role.
So there's a few things I want to come back to in there. First thing I'd like to ask is on design thinking. So, you know, there's a lot of people who have strong opinions on design thinking. So do you have any point of view on that?
Well, it depends on the opinion. I've heard a lot of opinions. You know, I haven't actually heard design thinking in a long time, which could be more of a an outcome of the type of organizations that I'm in that may not lean too heavily into design thinking. I think right now it's more called visioning or more like early stage UX. I don't hear people using the term as much as I did back in the IDEO, heavy IDEO days. So at the time, I loved it only because I do believe that the research process and UX process has to adapt, you know, different. I think when that occurred, when we doubled down on like innovation and design thinking, and Janaki Kumar was our UX leader at the time. She's just a great UX leader when it comes to UX in the enterprise space. And so when we moved over there, I mean, it was very clear that we were doing it to almost like reestablish ourselves as this innovative arm of SAP. So we worked really closely with Stanford D School. I just loved it. It was an opportunity to learn new tools, right? Because I always joke that user researchers have over 200 plus methods, you know, that we can choose from to study different aspects of the product experience. And so at the time, I hadn't had any tools that were more for early stage innovation products. These are products that may be informing a design process or maybe a long design process, because for very innovative projects, they start almost 3, 5, or 10 years before, depending on the product lifecycle in the company, because you have to do so much iteration, especially in regulated environments that require a lot of regulations and approvals. Like some of that stuff, the design team is just iterating. And so research has to play a rigorous, high quality role in that process. And I think design thinking gave some tools for that, especially when it came to landing some of that heavy research data. So I appreciated it because I was able to pick up some of those innovation toolkits to land UX research. I don't think it's a replacement for the entire research process or methods. And, you know, there were times where I did ethnographic work and I never think to even use the word design thinking because it has nothing to do with it. It's more about really immersing yourself within that user's environment and becoming that. Whereas design thinking to me felt like a tool to navigate that understanding and context and divergent and convergent thinking with your team. I think it just gave a lot of tools to how to bring them to the table throughout the research process, which you don't always get from the social sciences. You get how to do rigorous work and rigorous research and keep a humanistic perspective, which is great muscle to build, then you have to pair that with practical tools to bring the team along. And I think that design thinking literature kind of help with that. But I think if we, if we just compartmentalize the perspectives of these different tools, you know when to use them and when not to use them. And that's ultimately the essence of being a researcher throughout any company or multiple companies, is when you pick up what tool and where to do that investigation, you know.
Building on that a bit, how have you seen the field change from, you know, when you were in a usability role to now, and maybe, you know, we can start to sort of relate that to sort of research operations and how we're maturing the practice?
Oh, yeah. Great question. You know, I think the biggest change has been moving UX practitioners across the different customer and user lifecycle. I think when I started, it was very much have your researchers evaluating this product after it launches, after the fact, after the decisions. And so the big challenge was, oh, we got to get a seat at the table. We got to get up closer, you know? When in the beginning you had very strong scientists from academia who were, again, somewhere in a lab. They were all their knowledge was kind of stuck behind this R&D organization that you kind of would never see their paperwork unless you worked with that scientist. So it was like those are the two flavors, and that was about it. Over time, over the last 20 years, I saw UX practitioners sprinkled across the development cycle. So if you think about an end-to-end spectrum, right, you just see more of us sprinkled across that development and product and customer lifecycle. And the reason why I keep mentioning customer lifecycle is because I do think things like design thinking, it brought me closer to the sales folks. It brought me closer to customer success folks. And it was because of those tools, I was able to speak their language about scenarios and use cases, you know, and pain points. I mean, salespeople love that, right? And so they're all different types of flavors. However, there's all different types of flavors. It's like both the catch 20. It's a little bit of a double-edged sword, I guess. You know, we are a lot more plentiful across the customer and user lifecycle. We come in so many different flavors. I'm not sure. I think that lack of consistency may have oversaturated the narrative of what user research does. And so now you see research ops emerging to kind of help us just sort all of that out. These are your usability evaluators, right? This is where you want to put folks with these type of skill sets in UXR. If these are your social scientists, they're going to help us find the right problem to solve and even question some of the social and technical, social and cultural aspects to it, then you want to have them at this part. So they've got into that. I'm starting to see the need for more of a mature operations to help us sort out for a company how you actually utilize these insights. Because now we have gotten a seat at the table. We have more leaders. We have more directors that are representing researchers at that seat at the table. So the challenges are just a lot different now that we've gotten what we wanted as researchers embedded within business. But now we need a mature operations team to tell that story of our function in a meaningful way, you know, that doesn't, that showcases the variety instead of having that variety undermine our messages. So I think that's the meaty challenge right now, but we have definitely come a long way. We have a lot more leaders and a lot more roles sprinkled across the life cycle, which is great.
So for anybody who's listening that might want to step into an ops role in the future, what would you suggest they do to help get there? You know, are there other skills that they should be looking at? You know, what's useful?
I'd like to actually talk a little bit about specifically researchers like myself who come from about 15 plus years of user research before I started making this career pivot toward research operations and programs. And I think it's a different flavor of operations. I think for operations right now, some organizations still have challenges with infrastructure and budgeting and just the the foundational aspects to just run research, informed consent, NDAs. I would say if you're really into that aspect of research operations, go to the research ops community and they can give you a plethora of templates and toolkits to use there. If you are a researcher like myself and you're interested in getting into research operations and programs, I would start thinking really strategically about the pain points of your research lifecycle. I think one of the lowest hanging fruits is to take, for instance, the strategic research planning session. That's where a lot of decisions are made about what research is going to be studied, what research is going to be planned, how it's going to work with different individuals in the product development lifecycle. And it can really utilize that researcher's mindset, one, because of the rigor and making sure that the right study is associated and planned, but then two, how to support a researcher through research execution, not just the logistics and infrastructure, but when you think about the skills needed to navigate research, research execution, I think a researcher's perspective can be quite helpful to that journey, as well as traditional operations. Then the special sauce for researchers who want to get into ops and programs is at the end. People don't realize after the presentation, there's a whole life cycle to get that insight into an actual place where it can be utilized, whether that's in the corporate strategy, the business strategy, the operations, or even the product development or design. It's not, you know, it doesn't end at that presentation. And I think, like I was saying earlier, one of the benefits of our evolution is that we've gotten to the table where people want to hear our story. We have a lot of stories and insights and recommendations, but how do we activate it and integrate it within the company? And so that is an interesting space for, I think, researchers who want to navigate into operations and programs that I don't think has been addressed so far, because the infrastructure issue or just informed consents have been such a bigger, meaty thing to do, just executing the research. But now we've got it. And if your company does have it, or if you're in a position that has it, then I think introducing, as a researcher, introducing yourself into that end product to activate and ignite and integrate the research findings takes a lot of understanding of the research craft, because you have to be able to read, just like if you were reading code, right? You do need a certain level of technical expertise to read that information. Like insights, and then building structures and programs to integrate it within the company is an interesting space. But if you're interested in just getting into operations, I think starting with basic project management skill sets and going to that research ops community is the best place to look at those getting into that space. If you're a researcher that wants to get in that space, it's a different opportunity. And I would really focus on strategic planning up front and more of the insights integration and activation on the end, because we just don't have a lot of support there. I mean, ask any senior level researcher who's doing strategic insights how much work they have to do at the end and how that is tied to their performance. You know, it's a pretty big opportunity to support and make impact for a research team.
Well, and certainly, you know, at that end, there's certainly many ways in which you're focus on the anthropology of work comes into play. And so, you know, how are you trying to tie that all in? And how does this perspective of like even the digital divide come forward into the work you're doing today? Like, what lens do you bring upon the organization at this point in your career?
Yeah, so part of my time at Google, I work with the UX Leadership Council on programs to assess research maturity. So I help interview researchers across Google and even UX leaders who represent research on their views of research maturity. And I think this is an opportunity for researchers who do want to, you know, go into operations and programs at that strategic level, at that kind of portfolio level. You're looking at kind of a baseline for good, you know, the type of questions that a director level researcher or an executive, you know, and product are asking is how do we standardize, but understand a baseline for a healthy research, mature research organization. That's actually a meaty problem right now, because we've all just tried to get a seat at the table and tried to get this strategic work. No one really thought about, oh, when we get it, what's the baseline that says that, you know, this is what good research looks like. And I think that's a heavy investigation. No one person can just say it. If you ask any leader across any company, they'll all say different things. So understanding research maturity is something that I work into this kind of vision of, you know, the future of strategic research operations. And it's asking things like, okay, what's the impact of having a low mature organization? You know, what influences the fact that this is a low mature organization? Is it power dynamics? Is it not having that seat at the table? Is it cultural? Is it a lack of accountability? Is it how are we getting shared accountability? How do we hold our companies accountable to implementing the insights from senior researchers? All that hasn't been investigated. And so not only do you need a neutral, critical perspective, you'll need almost a critical reflexive lens in order to do that, to see that something may be impacting the research process that isn't beneficial, and it may not be within the organization. It could be. It could be something within the researchers. Oh, this is just a skills issue, more storytelling, which I think is always the thing for researchers. I'm going on a slight tangent, but I don't understand why anthropologists are constantly told, or people with anthropological methods, to take storytelling class. It's not that you can't improve it, but increase that muscle. It's always opportunity to learn. But if you think about the number of storytelling classes that we give to our user researchers, it bothers me. So I just feel like there could be a lot more there. Yes, storytelling, but what else do we probably need to increase the maturity of this organization? Something tells me that people who are trained in storytelling might not be it, right? You know, so it's just asking those critical lens, critical perspectives around maybe there are power dynamics, maybe there are politics that are deeper than the company knows, but the company doesn't know it, right? You know, maybe this high maturity organization that we found, they can be the benchmark and we can implement something that's similar to it. But if we never ask those critical questions in research, because of a number of reasons on this journey, I found that it can either be this attitude of that's not our job, that's someone else's job, maybe a UX director. But then I've talked to UX leaders who are kind of like, well, what do the researchers need? Where is the data that shows that they're having any gaps? Where is the data that shows that, you know, researchers, you know, presented their findings, but then no one ever came back to it ever in life again. So it's like a, you know, $1 million insight on the floor. Where is that data? I think we're really good at telling that story and very viscerally and very, you know, exactly how I'm telling it now with a strong conviction. But it wasn't until I, you know, actually dotted line to an operations person, a business operations person, that just said that that's not enough. You guys may think that it's enough, and it's great that you're showing your skills and your rigor with telling a story, but there's a whole business of research that needs to be communicated that's not being done. And I don't know, you know, we've all worked really hard to get a seat at the table. I just think we need more mature operations to help with it. So that research maturity is one area that I focus on. And then also this practice tracker where, again, you extend the strategic research planning process where you have your research projects. This is how long it's going to take. This is when I'll deliver it. You extend that to something more meaningful that actually goes across the research lifecycle. And just creating a research lifecycle in and of itself is something that I think a critical lens or research program ops person could help with. It's like organizational product environment. And I think they, Emma Bouton talks about this in her 8 pillars of research. Organizational context, but then once you select the research and execute the research, which is traditional tracker, but after that, what was the response and reaction? What was the decision made? Just capturing that data in a very disciplined, rigorous manner can start to emerge a heat map so that when you get into these conversations about the business of research or the operations of research, we actually have metrics and data about the practice, not just the product. I think so far we just send, yeah, we did X, Y, and Z, here's the deck. But that's not, you know, when you're at a table where people are talking about blockers to engineering or blockers to design, and we're like, here are these two decks. It's just not even aligned with the question that's being asked. So I just think we're ill prepared. And I know I may get a lot of flack from this, but I'm also offering a solution that I think there's something where anthropologists or applied anthropologists can pull from that literature on studying up, on critical reflexivity, on the culture of different organization disciplines, design, engineering, research, we almost speak different languages. But who's studying that and how it impacts ultimately the users?
And you know, the other thing there is that unless we do that kind of work, it's also very hard to communicate performance, you know, as an individual or as a team in a way that goes beyond just the product. And increasingly, you know, we see that there is a focus on performance within these orgs, and there, of course, have been headcount cuts, you know, in this environment. And so it's very important right now.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's an interesting space where I appreciate the opportunity, you know, to work closely with our leaders inside our company about thinking, just thinking through how we articulate that for research on behalf of research. I think more, you know, if we think about researchers and anyone evolving their career, and I'm not sure which title or anything like that, but it is something about going into that space and informing corporate strategy and business strategists with the right data about research. Because one of the limitations I've seen on this journey is that if we don't have a dashboard of data about research practice, then it doesn't matter. As much as it hurts to hear that, if there's no metrics, that means it doesn't matter, or it means it's going great and no one had the time and, you know, to put anything together and say differently. But I do appreciate that ownership that I think a company is asking a research practice to say, if we want to make this story more crisp about what the research practice is going through, how it's impacting their work and what roles they need, then let's rethink how we measure the research practice. Let's get more skill sets from our strategic thinking researchers or our researchers who study the anthropology or sociology of work or power dynamics and do it in a rigorous, ethical, and corporately responsible way. Let's get their perspective. And guess what? You have that all in your research team. I do think there's opportunity for us to think creatively at the research leadership level about how we design our teams, design our researchers to help with our own strategy. And if we don't take ownership of that at the leadership and operations level, then we're just waiting for a product person or a C-level person to say, okay, well, this is the decision I'm making then, right? And it's unfortunate, and they shouldn't do that. In some cases, they do it horribly and they make the wrong decision. I just think that my perspective is that, okay, let's take matters in our own hand. Let's redesign our team to get the data that will tell our story the best. We do this all the time for users. We do it for designers, but we don't do it really for ourselves and telling the story of ourselves, which I think can be powerful. We have the tools. Literally, we have D-Scout where we could do diary studies on ourselves, right? We could do it in a way that makes sense. We could do this autoethnographic perspective of our own practice and then apply it with your applied anthropology skill sets, right? We can apply it to corporate strategy discussions about where the future of research will go. Those are the moments that meet that autoethnographic, those traditional critical reflexive practices and methods are needed at that corporate and business strategy to at least get ahead of the conversations around the future of research in your organizations. And furthermore, I do want to, you know, in my process across the industry, I've had the opportunity to talk to a lot of program managers, research ops people, researchers, who, you know, have been on the other side of these decisions around headcount and their careers, only to be brought back to that same company because someone realizes, oh, we didn't realize how amazing your work was, right? I've heard that 4 times, and to me, that's enough because it's like, what is happening in our decision-making process? Have we even examined our decision-making process at the research level? And I know a lot of people still, it may sound on the surface like it's some radical thought and, you know, we're trying to understand power. I don't think so. I think it's just business ops. You know? I think it's just understanding the performance of our function at a practice level. But I don't even think we're putting the right critical lens on that decision-making process and we're reactive as an organization. Oh no, our field is being impacted. Oh no, you know, this role got eliminated. I hear it a lot in research operations. And I think, unfortunately, we need to examine what's happening at that leadership seat at the table. Are the leaders that are representing research even at that conversation? If not, why not? if we've worked so hard to get the seat at the table, how is it being utilized beyond just the storytelling and the product? So I just think we need to get ahead of that. And I think there's opportunities within our own organizations, research organizations, to simply redesign roles to take on more strategic operations and tell the story of our own function, not let someone else tell it. And we're the best storytellers at a company, you know, right?
It's great. So if anybody, you know, likes what they're hearing and they wanted to hear more of this, you have any talks coming up or?
Yeah. So I actually, I love for folks to check out Rosenfeld Media. That's where I've talked about my perspective on research maturity and the anthropological lens, kind of the critical reflexive lens and studying up in the research org to understand research maturity instead of studying down. And so Rosenfeld Media has the community workshops that are totally free that you can click on there. And then also they have, I presented at Rosenfeld Media's Advancing Research this year, where I go into depth about the this future of strategic ops and how as a researcher, and even senior level operations are kind of, they have some hidden talent that we're not really tapping into to accomplish what I was just talking about at that operations and leader level. And then upcoming, I have Epic. I'll be co-hosting a salon with Tamara Hale, and we'll be talking about how to make our research practice more creative through creative hobbies. So we both are really interested in how creative hobbies that have nothing to do with work make us more creative researchers. And the reason why I think that's important is because the future of these new emerging technologies will require us to think out of the box about our function. I think we'll have to broaden our lens quite a bit, and it will be quite challenging. It'll be a healthy challenge though, because we've never been forced to have to innovate on our research practice. But I think the future of these emerging technologies will force us to do that. And I just want us to be proactive and get ahead of it and leverage some of the expertise we already have right within our social science fields, you know? But those are three areas that, you know, past places you could check out this point of view, as well as upcoming.
Cool. And what's your creative hobby?
Oh, poetry. So I just published my first poetry book. Is called Wildflowers. I enjoy it. Just going through the process of being new at the creative process, also content creation, because I have an Instagram and I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm like every other millennial. I wish I knew what I was doing, like Generation Z, but I don't. But it's fun to do something new and do something creative without all the business constraints. And so when I come back in the workplace, I have a fresh new view because I went through that kind of exercise. But yeah, you can check out if you're into poetry. It is called Wildflowers, A Lifetime of Longing. I also have tote bags and stickers if you're into like novelty inspiration things, flowers and stuff like that.
I'll link to it. And so if anybody wanted to get in touch aside from Instagram, where would be a good place?
LinkedIn, of course. I'm also a super fan of LinkedIn. I just think it's an amazing app. So yes, please follow me on LinkedIn. You can search for Fatima Richmond and let's connect. I'd love to talk about anything that sparked anyone that's listening. If you have any questions, I try to respond within a week, depending on how crazy life is. I do have a very active 8-year-old. But I do respond, and I also love to be challenged on any thoughts, especially from the social scientists in the research world, because I do like to clarify to people I am an applied anthropologist. I didn't go off to get my PhD. I decided to apply all of that anthropological thought into the workplace. And it's been a very interesting journey. But I also think I sharpen my perspective when I talk to researchers, especially if you're heavy into any type of critical reflexive or critical organizational theory or power dynamics. I love to chat about that.
All right. Well, Fatima, thanks for coming on. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you so much, Matt. Thank you for having me.
Thank you all for listening to the Anthro to UX podcast. To learn everything you need to break into UX, visit anthrotoux.com. There you will find all the podcast episodes and career coaching resources. Please like, share, and subscribe. See you next time.